At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
You look at the game last night and you think to yourself, this Manchester City team are going to be the first Premier League team to score 10 goals in a match. It is going to happen. We are going to reach that high watermark.
Subscribe now to the OTB Football Podcast stream wherever you get your podcasts
and download the OTB Sports app.
You ain't shit! I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
My fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof at the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have, and, you know, you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not lies. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jim McGuinness in his life.
All Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5. You can text us on 53106 or streaming the conversation as well. You can listen on News Talk and watch us on the Off The Ball digital and social channels for Periscope and Twitter at Off The Ball, YouTube, Facebook, and on the OTB Sports app. Download it now for free in your app store. This week's Saturday panel, all about sports books in the run-up to Christmas. They say there's a book in everyone. And in the case of our three special guests today, the saying's right. The Nation Holds Its Breath is the autobiography from RT soccer commentator and Lyric FM presenter George Hamilton. Rebel Heart is Cork City legend John Caulfield's memoir with Robert Redmond. And Crossing the Line is Willie Anderson's story with Sunderland Independent rugby writer Brendan Fanning. Delighted to have you all three with you today. George, John and Brendan, how's it going?
Good, very good. Thank you, John.
Great to see you.
Yeah, great talking about it.
Great to see you. And we're 7 days out, lads. And I've got the books here in my hand. For anybody who's watching, The Nation Holds Its Breath from George and Rebel Heart from John and Crossing the Line, Brendan and Willie Anderson. Writing the book, lads, getting involved in this. George, what was this process like for you? Was it cathartic? Was it maddening? Was it brilliant? How did it all come about for you and did you enjoy it?
It was every one of those things, John, believe it or not. It was pretty interesting to dig back into the past. It all started with an approach from Conor Graham, the publisher of Merrion Press, and his editor, Patrick O'Donoghue, and they put a proposal to me that I should be doing a book. It was high time I did. I'd been around long enough, and I must have a story or two to tell. So I thought that sounds great. We had a cup of coffee, and then they said, we have a title. You just have to write the book. And when they said The Nation Holds Its Breath, then it became a process of trying to work out how do I go about telling this story? Because it's easy just to go story after story after story and present a series of anecdotes and have a bit of a laugh along the way. And I thought, no, it deserves something more than that, because I find myself on that Monday afternoon, 26th of June, 1990, in a very privileged position, broadcasting to RTE's biggest ever audience of 2.9 million people and coming out with a phrase that has stuck around all those years. And so I reckoned I had to explain how this young lad from, well, I'm not so young anymore, this lad from the Craigie Road in East Belfast ended up commentating on the finest moment of Irish football history. It was just an amazing thing to have done, I thought. So I started at the beginning, and that's when it became cathartic, because I was able to revisit the whole journey. And then also, on top of that, it became maddening, because as Brendan, I'm sure, will know, and John too, it's quite tough churning out the words. 80,000 words is quite a prospect. Brendan will have done that for Willie, which is a terrific book, by the way. Really enjoyed that. But I just found it maddening in the work that had to go into it. But maddening in inverted commas, because it wasn't really maddening, because when you see the finished product, you're delighted.
I hear the George Hamilton voice in every word when I'm reading this, George. How long did it take you to write it?
Well, it started up just as COVID was kicking in February 2020, and the manuscript was handed over in July of this year. So what's that, about 15 months?
Very good. And we want people to buy these books. That's what I'm going to say. So this is not a book interview club for the next hour, folks. We want people to buy these books over the next 7 days. So we'll just get maybe one story from each of you about the relevant books you're involved in. But we this is more about the process of the book and the sports books that you love and why sports books are great. And John Caulfield, was this a therapy session for you when you sat down with Robert Redmond and talked about all the glory days and the journey with Cork City and beyond?
Yeah, John, I suppose it was. You know, I had a long career with Cork. So when, you know, I finished in April 2019, Liam Hayes of Hero Books, Liam had asked me a number of times previously when I had been the manager, maybe 2017 to 18, would I be interested to write the book? And to be honest, I wasn't, John. I think I was just totally focused on managing Cork at the time. And so then when I finished up with Cork, Liam said, look, maybe this is the time to do it. So in that period when I finished, you know, I met Robert Redmond and we sat down for numerous days and weekends, and over about 6 months, really, we probably wrote 95% of the book. So it was, you know, while a lot of people were focusing on probably the managing career and the end in a way, like for me, it was more about, you know, the great days of how I started League of Ireland, you know, the way we were playing up and down the country. There was no dual carriageways, there was no mobile phones. No one could find you if you went missing. It was fantastic. And so it was just trying to go through the European matches. And I suppose really, you know, what a fantastic memories and friends and friendships I picked up over the years and the teams and players I played with. So it was recalling all that. So it was trying to be as honest and as accurate as I could be. And so it was, you know, it was an incredible experience, because I think at the time when I wrote it, I didn't expect to come back into football. I thought it was done, really. And but here it is, and you know, thankfully the book is out there, and I hope a lot of the League of Ireland people like it, because there aren't many League of Ireland books. I think when Liam first approached me, you know, he was just saying, you know, there's lots of Gaelic books, lots of rugby books and other sports, but very few in League of Ireland. And you know, so he was anxious to try and do something with a player stroke into management. And you know, I really enjoyed it, and hopefully for particularly a lot of the League of Ireland fans will enjoy that.
No, I think it'll do very well, first of all, on Lee's side and then beyond. John, very arresting start with the whole 2017 season, and when you won the double and you had Stephen Kenny and Dundalk and yourself battling it out of Cork City. And Brendan, you're trying to put somebody else's voice onto print. You're an experienced journalist with the Sunday Independent, and your subject here is Willie Anderson. Very interesting life. How difficult or easy, or what is it like trying to put somebody else's voice out there, and then when you read it, you're reading Willie Anderson's voice?
A few people have mentioned this, that they could hear Willie in the book. And I said, yeah, grand. And exactly, I've been asked that question, how did you do it? And I wish I had some clever response. I'd say that it was extremely difficult. It wasn't. It was pretty straightforward. We spoke, if not every day, every other day during the course of the project, as we called it. So I got to know him extremely well. And first, you know, I'd run everything past him. When I'd write it, I'd bounce it off him. And early doors, there were a few examples of, nah, geez, I wouldn't say that's not me. But we got over that fairly quickly. And yeah, after I'd say, geez, by the second chapter, I felt comfortable in Willie's voice, if you know what I mean. And I wasn't second guessing everything. Would he say this, you know, going back over tapes? Did he say, you know, he said that I need to change that. You know, it worked. You know, it worked quite easily, and I didn't find that a struggle. There were other struggles in writing the book. His voice wasn't one of them.
Did you know Willie well before you linked up with him and wrote this book with him, Brendan? Because you got to have a trust there.
No, we didn't. I knew him a long time. We weren't mates or anything like that. I knew him on two levels. One, through coaching. I would have been on a few coaching courses that Willie had given, and which were always interesting. And I would have written about him, obviously, as a journalist. So I knew him. We had our ups and downs a little bit over the years, which actually stood to us. because he was very keen that it wasn't going to be a hero worship affair. And in fairness to him, genuinely at no point in the book did he come back to me and say, no, there's no way you're putting that in, I'm going to look like an idiot. He is blessed with a huge heart and a very small ego. So we'd no issues on that score at all. And it was a really enjoyable process. Like, he really is a great fellow. And when you get to know him, he's very easy to work with. Infuriating in some regards. He couldn't remember a lot of stuff, or even worse, as we went to print, something, oh yeah, did I tell you this? And I say, no, Willie, you didn't tell me that. You know, this is a month after the thing is on the shelves. But anyway, we coped with that and we got on.
And you wrote a book about, was it From There to Here, about Irish rugby, Brendan. Was this the first book you'd ghostwritten?
Yeah, I would have ghostwritten columns for people at various points along the way in this indo. But it was the first time I'd done a book, and I spoke to a couple of colleagues of mine who'd done them to try and get a steer on what's the best way about it, because I genuinely had no rashes where I was going to start with it. And also, George might identify with this, you're dealing with stuff that happened a long, long time ago. So what do you lead off with? And how much detail can you go into in order to bring people back to that time? And also in Willie's case, a lot of this stuff was 40 years ago. So memories aren't what they used to be. So there was a lot of legwork. So we discussed an incident. I would say to him, okay, what about such and such a thing? What about Argentina getting locked up? Let's go through that. So I obviously had to go and talk to the other people who were locked up with him in Argentina, and the liaison officer who is still based in Buenos Aires, and other people who were on the tour. So probably on that chapter alone, I probably would have spoken to 20 or 25 people. And, you know, a lot of them had varying versions of events. I've never had to give evidence in a court case, but I'm told there's nothing unreliable in life as a witness. I can certainly concur with that.
And George, when you were constructing your book, did you have to speak to other people, fact-checking, or like, had you kept diaries, or what was the process behind that?
I had actually kept diaries, not in a formal sense, but I would often take down little notes of where I'd been and things that had stood out for me. And so there was a lot of material that I was able to resurrect. It was funny, a lot of it was on floppy disks. And of course, now we don't have slots for floppy disks. And I had great fun sourcing a floppy disk player that would play on my Mac. But the day I put the first floppy disk in and saw what was on it, I nearly jumped off the chair with excitement, because it was all there. And it was just a question of reading through it all and refreshing my memory. And then off we went with the writing process. I was in a bit of despair at the start, because I thought that the floppy disks, like the old Amstrad I had back in the 80s, might have been in the bin somewhere some time ago. But no, I have found them all, and they were all readable. And so that's where a lot of the material came from. And then a couple of magnificent resources, online resources, the British Newspaper Archive and the Irish Newspaper Archive. And if you ever forget anything about a specific incident, well, you can go and look up the Irish Independent, the Irish Times, the Belfast Telegraph, or whatever, and see it all reported there. And I just a lovely story that grew out of all this. In the book, I talk about my dad and the fact that he scored a hat-trick for Cliftonville against a now-defunct team, Queen's Island, back in the 1930s. And there's a commentator on BBC Radio Ulster called Barry Flynn, who out of the blue sent me a direct message on Twitter, which was a cutting from a Belfast Telegraph. Is this your dad's hat-trick? And it was. I didn't have it, but he had it.
That is fantastic, George. That's fantastic stuff. And the power of Twitter and the power of...
Yes, absolutely. Barry Flynn's his name. He's obviously, you know, like an Irish League historian, if he's prepared to have gone into that kind of detail to be able to turn up something like that at the drop of a hat. When I couldn't actually find it. I assumed it had been in the Ireland Saturday Night, which is the now defunct sports paper up north. And that's not online, but clearly it was in the daily paper and Barry was able to find it.
I'm reading about Bayern Munich, John Caulfield, and really funny stories, and obviously the brilliant performance that you know over the two legs in that UEFA Cup game in the early 90s. Was that easy to recall? Did Robert Redmond kind of do a lot of research with you around that? Or are all the matches just lasered into your mind that you played over the years?
Yeah, I think, John, a lot of them were. Obviously, you keep notes and that, but, you know, to be fair to Bayern Munich, that wasn't one that you were going to get up too quickly. So, you know, there was a lot of great detail. At the time, you know, we had a manager, Noel O'Mahony. Unfortunately, he's passed away now, but a phenomenal character of League of Ireland. You know, he would have been a player with Cork hips, and he had a reputation for, not taking for treating players fairly roughly. And he, you know, as a manager, he was no nonsense, and he was young for this growing up with Cork and trying to build that team. No, he was very much about the passion of Cork and taking no prisoners, and then sending the lads that came down from Dublin on the bus back home very quickly. And so by the time he got to Bayern Munich in 91, that team had been together for 4 or 5 years, and it was a tremendous bond. Most of the players were from Cork City, and we had a few outside players. And it was just one of those games where you end up playing in Musgrave Park. The game was moved to Musgrave Park because they had a stand that could hold 200 people. But at the time, there was a lot of controversy because the chairman of the club tried to up the prices, and there was a boycott by a lot of local city fans, which was very disappointing when you look back on it, because the official attendance on the day was only 4,500, where it should have been about 15,000. But it was one of those days where we ran ourselves into the ground. We went ahead, Effenberg equalised, and we were under the cosh for the second half. But just one of those days, they hit the crossbar. Phil Harrington made fantastic saves, and we rode our luck a little bit, but it was an incredible draw. And then obviously 2 weeks later, we ended up in the Olympic Stadium in Munich. Fantastic place to be. But more importantly, when we arrived, the beer festival was just after starting.
More important thing, John.
So, John, when we got the invitation when we arrived to see if we want to go to the beer festival on a Sunday night, you know, there was we were sprinting to get there, you know. So it was, you know, so it's just the time and you know, diet and nutrition and you know, eating pasta every day and all this type of stuff was a long way from where we were brought up at the time. So, you know, so we had an incredible experience over there. And then the Bayern Munich game, you know, it was nil all at half time, and up to 76 minutes was nil all, and we had one or two half chances. Invariably, they were all over us, but we still weren't too half chances. And but just, you know, they were the type of games you live for, because if you think of it from our point of view, we worked every day, you know. So I was never a professional soccer player. When I went into managing, I was. But, you know, so every day we were working in our day jobs, and you trained 3 nights a week, you played at the weekend. So we went to Europe. It was like a week's holidays, you know, and because you were able to train every day and you were able to enjoy the crack. So we're living the life of, we'd say, the professional soccer players we do in other countries. So it was unique from that point of view. And I think that's why a lot of those European trips were so exciting for us at the time, you know.
Did you commentate on that, George?
No, I didn't, funny enough. And I wish I had. But I'm reminded about it all the time by Tony O'Donoghue.
Oh, very good. Yeah, yeah. Good Spurs, man.
There's no way of avoiding it. And Dave Barry's moment of glory, of course. I can't remember the circumstances surrounding it as to why it wasn't covered. We tended not to cover League of Ireland teams in Europe in those days. I mean, obviously, looking back, it's something that should have been done. But hindsight's a wonderful thing. And, you know, where I started off at BBC Northern Ireland, they would cover the home leg on television for highlights. But they never sent it for a television away game. They did send. They never covered it on TV, so it would be done on the radio. But that was the way they did it. But RTE didn't do that. So sadly, Bayern Munich came and went, and it was left to the print journalists, like Brendan's colleagues, to tell us all about it and then maybe get the pictures back some other way. I think we might have had the pictures all right in Soccer Stadium at the weekend, but there wasn't any coverage, so I didn't get to commentate on what was undoubtedly what Cork City's finest hour.
And Brendan,
anyway,
yeah,
many,
yeah, absolutely. And Brendan, like when I read all these books, I'm reading extracts. It's often about the things around the matches rather than even which are more illuminating than the matches themselves.
But it's. I wouldn't complain about my job. at all, because it's considered to be the toy department, and that's fine. And every fellow wants to be lots of people want to be sports journalists. But I was lucky enough, I genuinely count myself lucky to have got in when I got in, which was the late 80s, when pre-professionalism, and, you know, John was talking about having a day job, and then football was secondary. So you were dealing with people like him, who had real lives and real things going on, and made them more interesting, and they were accessible. And there weren't media prevention officers stopping you getting to the players. And he wasn't, you know, John was never, as a player, nobody was coaching him, I imagine, in how to speak without saying anything, and how to be bland and how to be boring. So there was, you know, when Willie was playing rugby and growing up, you know, on the farm and in school and whatever, it was a bleak time, but it was a very interesting time. So there was, you know, it really was rich pickings. There's lots in it, and it would be much harder to do that job with somebody now, who is maybe early 30s and retiring. And
maybe Keith Earls an exception to that at the moment.
Yeah, obviously he is an exception for obvious reasons. But most fellows would just go from school into the academy. They've been in the gym since they were mid-teens. They've been on the diet that John was talking about. You know, they haven't had a real job, most of them. So they haven't had much experience of life. Keith Earls clearly is an exception to that, given his trials and tribulations, which he dealt with very honestly. And fair dues to Tommy Conlon, you were talking about getting the voice. My colleague Tommy Conlon, who wrote Keith Earls' book, or ghosted it, did a fantastic job. And he helped me with mine. He edited mine as well before I even gave it to the publisher. I had Tommy throw his eye over it. So I was blessed in that regard.
Very good. Got to take a break. Brendan Franning, George Hamilton and John Caulfield have all brought out books for Christmas, and obviously for their lives as well. And, you know, we're chatting to them about the process, and obviously, you know, great stories and what great sports books are out there as well. Alternatively as well this year, 531 06, you want to get in touch with any texts. Andre Agassi's book, Open, is brilliant, says Kay. Friday Night Lights, superb read, says Barry and Donabate. The Boys in the Boat, about 1936 Berlin Olympics, a team of underdog rowers from Seattle beat the best of the US rowing teams from the likes of Harvard, Princeton to qualify for the Olympics and win gold, written with a backdrop of Nazi Berlin as well. Excellent read. That is one of our textures in 53106. And we've got to really appreciate people's contribution to the audience of the show here. John Parker, once a runner. My top 10, part of this Texas top 10, Dark Trade, Donald McCray on boxing, Back from the Brink, Paul McGrath, Semi-Tough, Dan Jenkins, Ball Forward, Jim Bolton on baseball, Friday Night Lights, Buzz Bissinger on the NFL, The Football Man, Arthur Hopcraft, that is a great book, Born to Run, Chris McDougall, The Sweet Science, AJ Liebling, and Levels of the Game, John McPhee. Thanks so much for that comprehensive text on 53106. We're going to be back between 2 and 2:30 with George Hamilton, Brendan Fanning, and John Caulfield. More on their sports books and the books of the year. Back after this.
The Saturday Panel on Off the Ball. The Saturday Panel on Off the Ball.
And this is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through until 5. You can text us 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. Latest score from the Camogie Club final, sponsored by AIB. Al Arthur Ballack 2-6. Sarsfield 3 points. So the Wexford side, well clear in that one. And Aston Villa, Burnley is off in the Premier League. So only one game left standing today. Leeds against Arsenal from 5:30. This is the Saturday Panel. The voice of the boys in green and Lyric FM presenter George Hamilton's got a book out, The Nation Holds Its Breath. Cork City legend John Caulfield has also told his story with Robert Redmond in Rebel Heart. And Brendan Fanning wrote Crossing the Line, the story of Willie Anderson with Willie, in conjunction with the former Irish rugby international. We're delighted to have George, John and Brendan with us this afternoon. You can listen on News Talk and also watch us as well digitally and socially on the channels for Off the Ball, for Periscope and Twitter, at Off the Ball, YouTube, Facebook and on the OTB Sports app. You can text us 53106. Plenty of people giving their recommendations from across the country. And often in newspapers, folks, you get serialisations and extracts of books. So I suppose we want people to buy our book for Christmas. But if you could each give me one story to give us a taster for the audience, maybe, Brendan, I'm looking here with Willie Anderson, all these stories, the Haka, getting into trouble in Argentina, personal battles, coaching, tragedy. One thing maybe you might enlighten us about.
Well, the story that convinced me to approach and to do the book was... from a little snippet I'd seen he'd given in an interview to somebody else, and I was just gobsmacked when I read it. I knew about Argentina. I knew about him falling foul of the law over there, but I didn't know a whole lot about the detail. And he, for a prank, he was on the way home the night of the third game on the tour, and saw Argentine flag flying outside a government building, of which there were many, and he got another fellow, tossed him up on his shoulders, a colleague of his, not a randomer, I stress, and picked the flag, brought it back to the hotel, and the next thing, the cops were at the door, took machine guns, and himself and a couple of other lads are thrown into the back of police cars, flashing lights, sirens, the whole lot. Spent about 48 hours being questioned and arraigned, or whatever the term is. And then they were brought to the courthouse, and the sea of baying press people at the courthouse was just something that bowled them over, because Argentina was run by the military at the time, and this was an opportunity for them to get free publicity. Four fellas, in fact, on UK passports. And this was a couple of years before the Falklands blew up, so it was just food and drink. But when they had been sent down to the cells from the court case, Willie is sitting there and alone in this cell with etchings on the wall from previous occupants, and he's there and he's close to tears, and he looks over in the corner, and it's a little bit crude, but there is a piece of human excrement in the corner of the cell. And this is a couple of weeks after he left home to go on a rugby trip, which is going to be the best trip of his life. And he's sitting in a cell, just about to start crying, because he has committed this prank, which has gone wrong. And there are three other guys in the other cells on the back of this. And he's thinking, Jesus, how did I get myself into this mess? So when I heard about that, I said, yeah, look, we have to do this story.
How did he get out of it, Brendan?
Pardon me?
How did he get out of it?
How did he get out of it? Well, he didn't break out of it. It was the other three were seen to be, well, one of them, an English guy, got off literally, you know, a day or two later. The other two, Frank Wilson and Davey Irwin, did a couple of weeks in prison with Willie, and then they were let go. Willie was the culprit. So what he was sentenced to effectively was house arrest. So he did the guts of 3 months under house arrest in Buenos Aires, and then they realized effectively, look, we've got as much publicity out of this as we're going to get, so either we shoot him or we let him go. So that was it, they let him go.
That's an unbelievable story, and terrifying as well. And George, you were in Argentina in 1978. That was your first World Cup.
Yeah, and it was under the generals, but the thing was, they were putting their best face forward. So there was no indication whatsoever that there was any kind of military rule going on. The only indication that you could maybe ascertain was that the policemen, they wore navy blue fatigues as opposed to police uniforms. But that was the only thing that struck me. I mean, they did everything. They went out of their way to make this a success. They had a choir of school children singing Buenos Dias, Periodistas, on our first visit to the press center. They had wine and cheese party. Nobody knew Mendoza, where I was based, was the wine capital of Argentina. We all do now, but we didn't then. But we were taken to this polo club where there was a polo match laid on for the press, followed by this wine and cheese reception. Wonderful Argentine cheese, and even more wonderful Argentine white wine from Mendoza. So Argentina was like paradise when the World Cup was on there. The only thing that was lacking was a colour television, because although the pictures reached the rest of the world in colour, in Argentina, the infrastructure wasn't yet there. So we watched in grainy 405 line black and white as the rest of the world enjoyed this World Cup extravaganza. But it was terrific. Hey, how am I to complain? 6 matches in 4 weeks. Peru, Iran, Scotland beating Holland without Archie Gemmell slalom, and of course, Brazil. Now, how's that for a debut World Cup?
Is that your story from the book, George, The Nation Holds Its Breath?
Or give me another one if you...
Go on, give us another one.
If you like. It's another World Cup story. It's 1994, and Ireland are going to play, it seems like, Saudi Arabia or Belgium, in the next phase. So Jack goes down to see this game in Washington, and Tiger Bruin, the late Tiger Bruin, who was my minder on the trip, he and I are flying down on the plane. And Jack has been hastily got a seat on the plane so he can go and check out the next opposition for Ireland. And we're, RTE, it was clearly Flahulik at the time, we're up the front of the plane, and Jack comes on the plane and marches down the back and takes a seat in row 22 or whatever it is. So Tyke thought, that's a good floor manager, Tyke thought, hey, but this doesn't look good. We're up here, he's down there. We should tell the crew who he is. So Tyke got up and told the lead stewardess that that the Irish manager from the Soccer World Cup was on the plane. And she told the captain. The captain went bananas and said, what's he doing down the back of the plane? So Jack was brought up the front, given a tour of the cockpit, sat in the first class seat. And this was all great. And he's loving it. And when we arrived in Washington, it's the day of the game. So it's in the evening. And Jack is going to be picked up by a car. And there's a big sign up saying Coach Charlton. Jack marches over to the guy with the sign. And we're kind of making our way sheepishly out of the airport when he hollers at me, hey, you too. Come back here. There's no way I'm letting you get a taxi. And so we're in the car with Jack Charlton and his mate. So we go to the game. The game takes place. You might remember it. It was Belgium against Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia went in front with a mad goal that started like in the left half position. And then went to this guy just went on his way through the whole Belgian defense and scored. And it was 1-0. And that was got to half time. And Jack was obviously in the VIP area at half time. And Tyke went down to get him because the arrangement had been that if Jack was at the game, he'd talk to us at halftime. So he came up to our commentary position, but Tiger had to kind of prise him out of the VIP area. And when he came into the commentary position, to talk to me, he sat like this. And he talked to me with his back to me, which was like his protest.
Why?
The protest. He didn't want to be doing this. He should have been done in the VIP area. Then he left us. That's fine. Okay. So he goes back to where to see the second half of the game. Of course, the game ends up 1-0 to Saudi Arabia, and it's Holland that are going to play next. So this whole trip for Jack has been a waste of time. But anyway, that's not the end of the story, because as we're making our way out and we're going out through the official press exit, and Jack is there as well, and he says, hey, there's a mate. I'm going to have dinner with a mate of mine. Will you come? And we went, and it was on them. You know, most amazing. They took us to this restaurant in Washington to have the meal with them. Lovely time, lovely social early evening with Jack. And then we went back to get the train back to where we were staying in New Jersey. Tyke and I get the plane, I should say. And we're sitting on the edge of the runway for hours, it seemed, in a lightning storm before the aircraft was taxied back to the gate and we were all dumped off. There was no flight back. And the captain was the same captain who brought us down. He says something terrible that no airline pilot will ever like to hear. He says, when we said he was taking us back to Washington, back to New Jersey, and there'd be no problem getting the flight back to New York. And then, of course, the flight's off, and clearly what he's told us wasn't correct. There was clearly no chance of us getting back because of the weather. He said, how do you tell when a pilot's lying? I said, what do you mean? Well, he's moving his lips.
It's a different time, George. I mean, I wish it was like that now. You know, it's all obviously, there's a wall now, isn't there? But like, it seems that you got absolutely on great with Jack, and, you know, I'm sure you had your moments.
Yes, we had our moments, but they never lasted. And it's as Brendan said, you know, we spent the day basically with Jack, and we were just like mates who knew each other, not best mates, but like people who knew each other and got along together. He stayed on. We went back in a milk train, Tyke and I, overnight to get back to New Jersey. But yes, you're right. We were in the same hotel, for goodness sake, in Parsippany. And I think back to 1998 and the Euros, you know, 1988, when we were in the Vault Hotel in Dagerloch in Stuttgart for a couple of days before the first match. Niall Quinn's there. He came back into the lobby one day. He said, just discovered there's a tennis court outside. Anybody fancy playing tennis? And I said, yeah, I'll play tennis. I've played tennis regularly at the time. But there's no way when I got out there, I realized I was going to beat a guy like Niall Quinn, because I'm 5'6" and he's got a wingspan like a 747. There's no way I'm going to beat him. But it was a good afternoon. And at the bottom of that story is the fact that you've just alluded to, John, and Brendan mentioned earlier on, you were part of the party and you were part of the team, the greater team, and you'd access all areas basically apart from the dressing room, and they were prepared to have you as their friends and be part of the party and enjoy the experience.
Yeah, the trust seems to have broken down somewhere. John Caulfield, obviously you're on the other side, you've been player, you've been manager. I know you mentioned Munich there briefly before 2 o'clock, but is there anything else from the book you want to enlighten us about? Maybe just one story. Is it about the double run or anything else?
I think, you know, when you look back, it's the stories of being away, and obviously you mentioned Munich earlier on, John, but probably the greatest trip for us as players was when we ended up in Istanbul against Galatasaray, because we'd never anticipated the hostility and the the passion, I suppose, and the viciousness, you know, which was incredible. And over that game, they knocked us out. The following round, they drew Man United. And if you remember, that was the famous Eric Cantona incident of him getting sent off and supposedly getting a few digs from the police going down behind the goal into the tunnel. And we had witnessed that a few weeks earlier, and how aggressive the place had been. But I think, on a lighter note, when we arrived in Istanbul at our hotel, Manchester City at the time were sitting on the steps. They were out there to play a pre-season friendly. And Quinn was playing with Man City at the time. And we pulled up in our coach, and they were playing Besiktas or Fenerbahce, I'm not quite sure, the friendly match on the Tuesday night. And they were waiting to go off to the stadium to do their training. So we arrived for a Champions League game to play Galatasaray. And at the time, we were sponsored by Guinness. And Guinness used to always supply us with about 30 crates of our slabs of beer for the trips. And we had a fantastic kit man at the time, Mr. Coxley. He was a guy called Jerry Harris.
He just passed away.
Last Thursday. Fantastic guy. But Jerry's, one of his most important roles was to make sure he got the crates of Guinness on the plane, and you know that we were sorted. So as the bus arrives, Man City are on the steps waiting to go off to training. We're arriving to check into the hotel, and all the gear is going in and being brought in. And Jerry says, lads, a crate a man, you know, to bring in, because it was 30 crates you brought in. And we're with a crate under our arm, each one of the players carrying up the steps. And the Man City players are looking at us, and Quinny's going, ah, come on, lads, what's going on here? So it was just a sign of the time, I suppose. And I suppose when you think back about how you know funny it was, but even how silly or stupid it was, that was just the way it was at the time. And anyways, roll on after the match, and we had a good night afterwards, you know. But it was just, I think, the ironicness of a Premier Division team were, you know, looking at us. They're out for a friendly. We're carrying slabs of beer, going into the hotel to play a Champions League game. Not too nice later, you know. But
You had a few spare slabs at the end, did you, John?
Sorry?
You had a few spare slabs at the end.
Well, funny, what happened, John, was that it was the first leg of the game over there. And we actually lost 2-1, and we were expected to get well beaten. And Pat Morley scored. We were 2-0 down. We scored near the end of the game. And the crowd changed dramatically in the stadium. The whistling and the hissing towards our own team, you know, was incredible. And their players, like, were, you could see that they didn't want the ball. And it was like, you could see that you could feel the stick and the abuse they were getting from the terraces, because it was 30,000 at the match. And we were absolutely elated after the match. So we went down to the dressing room, and we weren't allowed to leave for about an hour and a half after the game, because the bus had been damaged, and they said for our safety we had to hold on. So we were buzzing, and we all wanted to just get back to the hotel to get out, you know, because we were celebrating, and it was a European night. And when we got back to the hotel, we were advised not to leave. It wouldn't be safe if we were identified in around the city. So we stayed in the hotel that night, and we had a fantastic occasion. And most of the waiters were either Fenerbahce or Besiktas supporters, so they were quite thrilled with us, and we had a good night.
Mad story. That's just mad stuff, John. And on a serious note, yeah, very sad about Jerry. He was very much the lifeblood of the club, wasn't he?
Absolutely. You know, he was a gentleman. He had different roles between going back before Cork United, Albert Rovers. He actually was involved in as one of the directors of the club, but in the role for us, he had been sort of the secretary administrator. He had been a coach for a little spell, and obviously he was a kit man towards the end of his career, but he was just a really humble, beautiful person, and there was no one that would say a bad word about him. He was just that type of person. So it was a sad loss, and but he was, I suppose, if you talk about Coxley, Mr. Coxley, he was the guy that was that person.
Yeah, well said, John. We're speaking to John Caulfield, George Hamilton and Brendan Fanning here about Sportsbook because they're all involved. I have them here. If anybody's watching, George Hamilton, the nation holds its breath. John Caulfield, Rebel Harsh, all the success of Cork City, and Brendan Fanning with Willie Anderson crossing the line on Off the Ball Saturday here on News Talk 53106 for the listeners getting involved about their favourite sports books. Afternoon, John. Slaying the Badger, an amazing read, the story of the greatest American cyclist of all time, Greg LeMond, and Bernard Hinault's battle for the 86 Tour de France, says Pat. Best sports books on 53106 for basketball fans, I would highly recommend Hanging from the Rafters by Kieran Channon, The Book of Basketball by Bill Simmons, and The Golden Boys by Cameron Struth, about the dream team from the Barcelona Olympics, says Liam in Limerick. In Sunshine and in Shadow about the Belfast boxing scene from a couple of years ago is absolutely incredible. Donald McRae's got a wonderful flowing and descriptive style of writing. The detail is awesome, an important story, writes Sinead in Kinsale. And Circus Maximus on sporting infrastructure, an incredible read on the nonsense of hosting the World Cups and Olympics. Brendan Fanning, you probably haven't had a chance to read that many sports books, but maybe you have in 2021. Anything else you recommend that's not your own?
The best one I've ever read, it's still, and it stood the test of time, is Paul Kimmage's A Rough Ride. absolutely outstanding stuff. I'm halfway through, and you just mentioned there, Donald McRae's book.
Yeah.
I'm not a boxing fan at all, but got very good reviews, and it's as much about the troubles in Northern Ireland as it is about boxing. Obviously, there's a... It's a remarkable story in how sectarianism was put to one side when boxing was going on. It's incredible how it unfolded. That's a pretty good read. The other one, I haven't read it this year. I came across it before. It's Confessions of a Rugby Mercenary. A guy called John Danielle, a Kiwi who played rugby in France, where it is just like dog rough. And if you are the hired help, you're expected to lead the charge week after week after week. And it's a really, really good insight into the trials and tribulations of earning your corn in the French top 14.
Very good. And I'll be marking them down. I laughed because I said A Rough Ride an hour ago when Shane Hannon asked me my favourite sport book was, Brendan. George Hamilton, either this year or previously, any sports books that you highlight that's not your own?
We mentioned Back from the Brink, Paul McGrath's book. I think my favourite of all was Tony Castorina with Paul Kimmage, Full Time, which is not very thick, but it's a great read, and it's very, very, very honest. Mm-hmm. The one I enjoyed this year, they had me review it for the Irish Independent, was Peter Schmeichel's One, which, as he says himself, is not his first autobiography. I mean, he published one, he said, one of those cheap and cheerful football books that players of my era knocked out quickly without giving it any great detail or depth. Well, this is better than that. It's he's got it right second time. And it starts in Camp Nou in 1999, which is an occasion I remember well, and goes on from there. It's lovely to get the insights into bits and pieces of Manchester United and how the disappointments, how he went to Portugal and he was to come back, and Alex Ferguson decided he didn't want him back again. And he would find himself out of work and on the way to the airport with all his luggage, and had to go back to the apartment he no longer owned because... he had, to all intents and purposes, left Portugal. There's a lot of honesty in there. A lot of it's better than your average, I'd have to say. It wouldn't be my favourite book because Peter Schmeichel is not my favourite goalkeeper. But there you go. It's one I mightn't have picked up, but I'm glad I did because, as I say, they asked me to review it. It was good, and I'd recommend it. I'd recommend it because there's plenty in it. It's quite a big book, and there's plenty in it. The background in Denmark I enjoyed fully, and. You know, what has happened to the rest of his family? What happened to the backstory? You know, his roots in Poland, and his dad was a bit of a spy at the wartime and all that, or his granddad, rather. All that sort of stuff. It's just great background, well filled in. It's called One.
Yeah, no, I've read it, George, and the way he overcame nerves. Quite a nervous goalkeeper when he was young, and then he turns up at Man United and he's very much this dominant figure, which was interesting that he's able to just change his mindset, and it was fascinating. I'm just going through some of the books of the year here. Champion, a memoir by Pat Smullen, obviously that's a poignant read. Francis Crowley, Andy, Lessons Learned in Pursuit of Glory from Andy Moore, and the friend of OTB, about his time with Mayo. Devotion, a memoir by Mickey Hart, obviously it's a tough read at times, but definitely worth getting. Dark Blue by Shane Carthy, the former Dublin footballer. Unbroken by Aidan O'Mahony, the Kerry All-Ireland winner. Crossing the line, as we have here from Brendan and Willie. This Is Your Everest by Tom English and Peter Barnes. I'm looking forward to reading this at Christmas, Brendan. I think this is very well regarded, this one.
Yeah, that's a very good book. Really enjoyable. They brought it out ahead of the Lions tour last summer. And it goes back to the Lions tour in South Africa in 1997, which was the first tour of the pro era. And I was lucky enough to get on that. I was out covering Ireland, had a development tour in New Zealand and Samoa, and I did a couple of weeks in that, and then undertook the longest sequence of flights in my life, which, please God, I'll never have to do again, to get from Apia in Samoa to Cape Town to arrive there about a week before the test series. And it was absolutely epic. Really, really fantastic. And the Lions won 2-1, just to put the icing on the cake. But it's the style of the book, the way it's done, is all in first person pieces. So for the sake of argument, let's say there are 30 people or maybe 35 people interviewed over the course of the book, and you get it in bite-sized chunks as you go. And Tom has used that mechanism before in doing a book, No Borders, about Irish rugby, and it worked very well. And it worked very well in This Is Your Everest as well. So it really does take you back, and particularly from the South African side. I remember being on that tour, I could not for the life of me understand why they just didn't kick the ball up in the air and mow over Neil Jenkins, who was at fullback for the Lions. Like, it was just screaming off the page. So it gave you a good insight into the turmoil that was going on in the Springbok camp, which obviously facilitated the Lions winning the series. So, yeah, it's really good.
There's no coach tweeting at the time as well, back in 1997.
He can't stay off it, can he? I tell you, he's got a runaway ego, that fella. There's no doubt. Every time he loses a muscle, he's posted.
It's the strangest thing. It's the strangest thing I've seen. The funniest and the most original and the strangest thing I've seen in the last while on Twitter, being a Twitter observer. John Caulfield, a book maybe from this year or previous years you'd recommend for the listeners? That's not your own Rebel Heart?
Yeah, John. I've obviously read a lot of sports books. Recently, the Milers, obviously the contrast between John Miler, who are really strong in jail all his life, David getting the move to England to be a professional player, and the contrast, and really good read. And you know, obviously, how that John attended every game for David. He also was his agent. So on a cold Tuesday night, up in Carlisle or down in London, he was at every match for David. But it was just a contrast in their careers. I suppose going back, John, there are very few League of Ireland books. Neil Horgan had the rise and fall of Cork City, a fascinating number of books about his career in the Celtic Tiger time, when they were getting incredible wages in League of Ireland, and how the club would bust, and how they weren't getting paid towards the end of 2008 and turning up without getting their wages. So it was the contrast of that era and at the time. And going even further back, one of my memories, maybe, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, Eamon Sweeney had a book out, A Bit of Red, about his time growing up in Sligo, going into his father's Sligo Rovers, going in with his family. And so it's a very interesting read, and it's fascinating, particularly if you have interest in the League of Ireland. And,
And hopefully we won't go United now in a few years, John.
Sorry, John.
Hopefully there will be. Barcelona, The Rise and Fall of the World's Greatest Club by Simon Cooper. That's definitely one I'm looking forward to reading over Christmas. Flight or Fight, we mentioned, by Keith Earls and Tommy Conlon. Grassroots Stories in the Heart of the GA by PJ Cunningham as well is definitely worth checking out for Christmas. So before we finish up, John Caulfield, George Hamilton and Brendan Fanning, thanks so much for your time ahead of Christmas and to talk about sports books. Just about the year, Brendan, the All Blacks, fantastic stuff. Are you excited about the next couple of years, this World Cup cycle under Andy Farrell and the men's team? Obviously, there's challenges in the women's game at the moment, but I suppose the progress report, is it from the men's side? Is it a positive feeling around Ireland at the moment?
Yeah, I was really becoming pretty concerned at how long it has taken Andy Farrell to get up to speed, particularly given the length of time he was an assistant coach and seeing close up what was going on when he was there under Joe Schmidt. And for some reason, it's taken him fully two seasons. But their form of late has been really, really good. So if they can keep that going into the Six Nations, then it'll be good. And that is a question of keeping a handful of key players fit ahead of the World Cup and the ongoing battle to get into the semi-final, which we have yet to achieve. So, yeah, a lot to look forward to there.
Absolutely. And it's... But this forfeiture thing in rugby at the moment, Brendan, I feel it's very unfair. Do you?
Sorry, I think you're breaking up a bit there, John.
Sorry, just the forfeiture of games in the Champions Cup, I feel is very unfair. There surely is another way of getting around this, is there?
Yeah, life is full of things that are unfair. Yeah. And sport is a good reflection of life and its unfairness. And EPCR are like, they're spinning at the moment. When I say spinning, I mean they're spinning around trying to figure out what's going on. It's very, very difficult. And they're not making a brilliant job, but they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult to get sport up and running in the current climate. So I would be cutting a fair amount of slack to any administrator who is sitting there thinking, what the hell are we going to do next? It really isn't easy.
John, Galway United, what's the feeling about the next couple of years? You're going to be there for a while?
Yeah, I'm here for two more years, John Hope. Yeah, we put a lot of structures on the ground. Again, it's really a strong sports city. Soccer is strong. But Galway have spent a long time in the first division over a period of 15 years. Most of their time has been in the first division, which has been disappointing. And it needs to be in the Premier Division, but it's very difficult with the first division only getting one team up. And obviously, it's added this year with the likes of Waterford getting relegated, Cork City obviously being down there, Limerick. So it's not good for the League of Ireland that all the Southwest clubs are all in the first division. And, you know, that's disappointing. But from a Galway context, we're obviously hoping the next year we can put a big push on and see can we get that top spot. But it's going to be a huge challenge. But at the same time, we love doing what we're doing. And we're hoping that, you know, next year we can do a second this year. We're hoping next year that we could go up, you know.
And I read about your battles in the book Rebel Heart there with Stephen Kenny when he was Dundalk manager, you were Cork manager, especially around 16 and 17. John, how do you feel Stephen's doing, the Republic of Ireland team? Are you excited about 2022?
Yeah, I think we all want to see can we get back to qualifying for the major tournaments. You know, there's nothing worse. You know, George has been with his fantastic career, being at World Cups and European Champions. There's nothing worse watching those competitions and we're not involved in them. Because we have the great memories of Italy and USA. So, and that's really where, you know, the younger, you know, it gave soccer a massive drive at that time. And, you know, so we're desperate to get back there. So, you know, what Steve is doing this thing, it's very, very difficult. But from an era for a couple of years where we were struggling to score goals and we lost Robbie Keane, all of a sudden we look like we might be able to score goals going forward because our last number of matches have shown, you know, that we've created lots of chances and scored goals. So hopefully we can. It is difficult, and but it's one of those ones where, you know, it's Stephen has done very well after a slow start, but ultimately we need to qualify for tournaments, and that's what's going to be judged on at the end of the day.
I feel there's a buzz around both the men's and women's team at the moment in the Republic of Ireland, George. Would you feel that, having been in the trenches with them for so long?
I'd agree entirely. I think it would have been grossly unfair to have judged Stephen Kenny on one campaign which began so badly under the cloud of COVID, and all that happened in the course of that campaign, all the upset. I think it's absolutely right. You know, if he's good enough for the job for one campaign, he should at least have a chance to feet under the table. Brenda made the point about Andy Farrell, you know, and have a go again to see how that goes. And I would be hopeful that one way or another, Nations League or through the group at a playoff, that they might make it to Germany for the Euros. And certainly the women's team seems to be on the way. I mean, it's remarkable what has been achieved and how they've turned the corner under Vera Pauw. And I think soccer at the moment is in a good place in terms of the Irish international setup for both the men and the women.
And George, just to finish, you got finally an Olympic gold commentary this year.
Yes. Yeah, 11 Olympics. I'd never done an Irish gold medal. I'd done gold medals at Europeans and Worlds and so on, but never an Irish gold medal at the Olympic Games. But it finally came with the two boys, and they rode up that 2,000 metres, and it was something else. It really was. It was like the, you know, the cherry on the icing on the cake.
Well, it's a fantastic career, George. I'm holding up the books here. The nation holds its breath. Crossing the Line, Willie Anderson and Brendan Fanning, George Hamilton, The Nation Holds Its Breath, and Rebel Heart with John Caulfield and Robert Redford. Robert Redford, like I know it's nearly Christmas, lads. I need to take a few weeks off after saying that. I know it's Robert Redmond. That was a Freudian slip of magnificent proportions. Lads, the best of luck with the books, and have a great Christmas. And listeners out there, all I can say to you folks is buy the books. They're a great read, and we really appreciate you coming on the Saturday panel. Thanks, lads.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Happy Christmas.
See you, lads. Take care.
The Saturday Panel on Off the Ball.